8. Just as Reed and Vern were first noticing the approach of Barry Holden's RV, Terry Coombs entered the Olympia Diner and walked to the booth where Frank and Deputy Pete Ordway were sitting. Frank was less than happy to see Coombs up and about, but concealed his displeasure as best he could.
"Yo, Terry."
Terry nodded to both men. He had shaved and changed his shirt. He looked rocky but sober.
"Jack Albertson told me you guys were here."
Albertson was one of the retired deputies who had been pressed back into service 2 days before.
"I got some pretty bad news from Bridger County 15 minutes ago."
There was no smell of booze about Terry. Frank hoped to change that. He didn't like encouraging a man who was probably an incipient alcoholic, but Coombs was easier to work with when he'd had a few.
"What's going on in Bridger?" Pete asked.
"Wreck on the highway. Judge Silver went into Doar's Hollow Stream. He's dead."
"What?"
Frank's shout was loud enough to bring Gus Vereen out of the kitchen.
"It's a damn shame," Terry said. "He was a fine man."
He pulled up a chair.
"Any idea what he was doing over there?"
"Went to speak to an ex-FBI guy he knew in Coughlin about helping to talk sense into Norcross," Frank said.
It had to have been a heart attack. The judge had looked horrible, washed out and shaky.
"If he's dead, I guess that's out."
With an effort, he composed himself. He'd liked Judge Silver, and had been willing to go along with him up to a certain point. That point was erased now.
"And that woman is still at the prison."
Frank leaned forward.
"Awake. Norcross was lying about her being in a cocoon. Hicks told me."
"Hicks has got a poor reputation," Terry said.
Frank wasn't hearing it.
"And there's other strange things about her. She's the key.
If the bitch started it, she'll know how to stop it," Pete said.
Terry's mouth twitched.
"There's no proof of that, Pete. And since Aurora started halfway around the world, it seems kind of far-fetched. I think we all need to take a deep breath and just..."
Frank's walkie came to life. It was Don Peters.
"Frank, Frank, come in. I need to talk to you. You better answer this thing because they fucking..."
Frank raised the walkie to his lips.
"This is Frank. Come back and watch the profanity. You're going out over the...
They fucking robbed the guns,"
Don yelled.
"Some decrepit old piece of shit sent us on a wild goose chase, and then they robbed the fucking guns right out of the fucking sheriff's station."
Before Frank could reply, Terry snatched the walkie-talkie out of his hand.
"Coombs here.
Who did?"
"Barry Holden, in a big mother humper of an RV. Your dispatcher said there were others with him, but she's 3/4 out of it and don't know who."
"All the guns?" Terry asked, astounded. "They took all the guns?"
"No, no, not all. I guess they didn't have time, but plenty of them. Jesus Christ, that RV was huge."
Terry stared at the walkie in his hand, frozen. Frank told himself he ought to keep his mouth shut and let Terry work through the computation on his own, and he just couldn't do it. It seemed he never could once he was angry.
"Do you still think we just need to take a deep breath and wait Norcross out? Because you know where they're going with those weapons, don't you?"
Terry looked up at him. His lips pressed so tightly together his mouth was almost gone.
"I think you might have forgotten who's in charge here, Frank."
"Sorry, Sheriff."
Under the table, his hands were so tightly clenched they were shaking, the nails digging crescents into his palms. Terry was still staring at him.
"Tell me you put someone out there on the road to the prison."
"It would be your own damn fault if I didn't, drunk as you were."
"Ah, but who had been plying him with the booze?"
"I did. Wrangle and Barrows."
"Good. That's good. Which unit are they in?" Frank didn't know, but Pete Ordway did.
3.
Don was blabbering on, but Terry cut him off and pressed send.
Unit 3, Unit 3, respond. Right now. Right now.
Chapter 8. 1. At the squawk of the radio, Reed Barrows told Barry to stay put.
No problem, Barry said.
He gave the side of the Fleetwood three knocks, a message to Willie Burke, crouched behind the curtain that separated the front of the RV from the back, that it was on to Plan B. Plan B was pretty simple. Beat it while Barry provided as much of a distraction as possible. It was paramount that the guns got to the prison and that his girls were safe from harm. Barry didn't have to think twice about it. They'd arrest him, of course, but he knew a terrific lawyer. He placed a hand on Vern Rangel's shoulder, gently easing him past the front of the RV.
Sounds like someone at the station's got a full diaper, Rangel observed cheerfully, moving thoughtlessly along with the lawyer's guidance. Where are we going?
Where they were going was away from the RV, so that one, Rangel didn't see Willie Burke sliding into the driver's seat, and two, to give the Fleetwood room to go forward without running anyone over. Barry couldn't tell the officer that, though. A concept that he had endeavored to impress upon his girls was that the law was impersonal. It wasn't about your feelings, it was about your argument. If you could partition yourself off from personal preference entirely, that was for the best. You wanted, really, to remove your skin and assume the skin of your client, while at the same time hanging on to your brain. Gerda, who had been asked on a date by a high school boy, just a sophomore but still much too old for her, had recently tried to get her father to take her on as a pro bono client to argue to her mother that she was old enough to go to the movies with the guy. This had been exceptionally clever of Gerda, but Barry had recused himself on the grounds of their familial relationship. Also because, as her father, he had no intention of letting her go anywhere with a boy who was almost 15 and probably got hard every time the wind blew. If Carrie Benson wanted to spend time with her that badly, he'd said, then Carrie could buy her an ice cream sundae at the Dairy Treat right here in town. And in broad daylight. What Barry had chosen not to express to Gerda was the sticky provision of the utterly culpable. Sometimes you pulled on your client's skin only to find that they, you, were astoundingly, hopelessly, no way to even pretend, guilty as original sin. When this situation arose, the only sensible tactic was to distract and disrupt, litigate minutia, gum up the wheels, and delay. With luck, you might wear the opposition down until they offered you an advantageous deal just to be rid of you, or better yet, irritate or flummox them into screwing up their case altogether. With that in mind, he improvised with the most dumbfounding question he could come up with on short notice. Listen, Vern, wanted to take you aside and ask you something.
Okay.
Barry leaned forward confidentially.
Are you circumcised?
Rain sprinkles dotted the surface of Vern Rangel's glasses, obscuring his eyes. Barry heard the engine of the RV turn over, heard the clunk as Willie put it into drive, but the cop paid no mind. The circumcision question had put him in mental vapor lock.
Gee, Mr. Holden.
Vern absently shook out a handkerchief and began to refold it.
Kind of personal, you know.
Behind them there was a thud and the whinge of metal grinding against metal. Meanwhile, Reed Barrows had scooted into the driver's side of the cruiser to take Terry's call, but the mic slipped out of his damp hand. The seconds that elapsed while he bent to retrieve it from the footwell and untangle the cord were important because that got Willie Burke settled in driving mode.
Roger, this is Unit 3. Barrows speaking. Over, Reed said once he had the mic again.
Out the window, he saw the RV swerving around the front of the cruiser to the gravel shoulder and grassy embankment on the southbound half of the road. This vision didn't alarm Reed. It perplexed him. Why was Barry Holden moving his RV? Or was Vern moving it so someone else could get by? That didn't make sense. They needed to sort out the shyster and his Fleetwood before they dealt with anyone else who wanted to drive through. Terry Coombs' voice blared over the radio.
Arrest Barry Holden and confiscate his vehicle. He's got a pile of stolen guns and he's headed for the prison. You hear me?
The front end of the RV bumped the front end of the cruiser. The mic jumped out of Reed's hand a second time,
and his view through the windshield swung away as if on hinges. Hey!
2.
In the back of the RV, Jared lost his balance. He fell off the couch and onto the guns.
You okay? Garth asked.
The doctor had kept his feet by pressing his back against the counter of the kitchenette and grabbing the sink.
Yeah.
Thanks for asking about me. Michaela had managed to stay on the couch, but she'd fallen over onto her side.
Garth realized that he adored Mickey. She had sand, as the old-timers like to say. He wouldn't change a thing about her. Her nose and everything else was as close to flawless as you could get.
I didn't have to, Mickey, he replied. I know you're okay because you'll always be okay.
3.
The RV rolled slowly along, hugging the sloping roadside at a tilted angle and doing about 15 miles an hour, shoving the cruiser aside. Metal squalled against metal. Vern gaped and spun to Barry. The lawyer had pissed right down his leg. Vern therefore slugged Barry in the eye and dumped him flat on his rear end.
Stop the RV! Bellowed Reed from the open door of the shifting cruiser. Shoot the tires!
Vern drew his service weapon. The RV broke loose from the cruiser and began to pick up speed. It was at a 2 o'clock angle as it moved off the shoulder, now headed back for the center of the road. Vern, aiming for the right rear tire, triggered too quickly. His shot went way high, puncturing a piece of the RV's wall. The vehicle was about 50 yards distant. Once it gained the road, it would be gone. Vern took a moment to reset and aimed again, properly, focusing again on the rear right tire, and fired into the air as Barry Holden tackled him to the ground.
4. Jared, on the floor, his back poked in half a dozen places by gun sights and gun barrels, was deafened by the blast. He could somehow feel the screaming around him, the woman, Michaela, Flickinger, but he couldn't hear it. His eyes found a hole in the wall. The bullet had made an opening like a burst firecracker top. His hands, flat on the floor of the RV, felt the wheels moving below, gaining speed, thrumming on the hardtop. Flickinger still had his feet. He was braced at the kitchen counter. Nope, it wasn't Flickinger who was screaming. Jared looked where the doctor was looking. The cocooned figures lay on the couch. A bloody cavity had opened at the sternum of the third in the row, the oldest of the three girls, Gerda. She stood up from the couch and staggered forward. She was the one that was screaming. Jared saw that she was moving at Michaela, who was huddled at the end of the parallel couch. The girl's arms were raised, torn loose from the webbing that had held them fast to her torso, and the impression of the open, howling mouth under the material was vivid. Moths spilled from the hole in her sternum. Flickinger caught Gerda. She spun, and her hands clawed at his throat as they wobbled in a circle and went tripping over the guns on the floor. The two bodies crashed against the rear door. The latch snapped, the door flew open, and they fell out, followed by a rush of moths and a stream of guns and bullets. 5. Evie moaned.
What? Angel asked. What's wrong?
Oh, Evie said. Nothing.
Liar, Jeanette said. She was still slumped in the shower alcove. Angel had to hand it to Jeanette. She was almost as stubborn as Angel herself.
That's the sound you make when people die.
Jeanette inhaled. She cocked her head and addressed an invisible person.
That's the sound she makes when people die, Damien.
I guess that's true, Jeanette, Evie said. I guess I do that.
That's what I said, didn't I, Damien?
You're seeing shit, Jeanette,
Angel said. Jeanette's gaze stayed on the empty air.
Moths came from her mouth, Angel. She's got moths in her. Now let me alone. I'm trying to have a conversation with my husband.
Evie excused herself. I need to make a call.
6. Reed heard Vern's shot as he hurled himself over the police cruiser's console and jerked open the passenger door. He glimpsed the rear end of the RV as it lumbered over beyond the slope, its back door flapping back and forth. 2 bodies lay in the road. Reed unholstered his service weapon and ran toward them. Past the bodies, there was a trail of 3 or 4 assault rifles and a few handfuls of ammunition scattered among them. When he reached the bodies, he stopped. Blood and gray matter painted the pavement around the skull of the prone man who was nearest. Reed had seen his share of corpses, but the mess here was notable, maybe a prize winner. In the course of his fall, the guy's glasses had flipped up to rest on the fringe of his curly hair. The arrangement of the glasses gave him a perversely warm and casual look, a teacherly aspect, as he lay dead in the road with his brains splattered on the asphalt. A few steps further on, a female was sprawled on her side in the position that Reed himself often adopted when he was on the couch watching television. Her mask of webbing had been scraped away by contact with the road, and the skin that remained was tattered. From what was left of the face and of her body, Reed could determine that she was young, but not much more than that. A bullet had torn a large wound in her chest. The girl's blood flowed onto the damp pavement. Sneakers slapped against the pavement behind Reed.
Gerda!
Someone screamed.
Gerda!
Reed turned and Barry Holden rushed past him, falling to his knees by the body of his daughter. Vern Rangel, nose bloodied, staggered up the road after Holden, bellowing that he'd circumcise him, the fucker. What a hill of shit. A smeared guy, a dead girl, a howling attorney, Vern Rangel with his blood up, guns and ammo in the road. Reed was relieved that Lila Norcross was not currently serving as chief, because he would not have wanted to even begin to attempt to explain to her how it had happened. Reed grabbed for Vern a second too late, catching just a piece of fabric at his shoulder. Vern shook him off and swatted the butt end of his pistol across the back of Barry Holden's head. There was an ugly cracking noise, like a breaking branch, and a gout of blood. Barry Holden tumbled face first onto the ground beside his daughter. Vern squatted beside the unconscious lawyer and began to hit him again and again with the butt of his gun.
Fuck you! Fuck you! Fuck you! You broke my nose! You...
The young woman, who should have been dead and wasn't, grasped Vern's jaw, wrapped her fingers over his lower teeth, and jerked him down to her level. Her head lifted and her mouth snapped wide, and she buried her teeth in Vern's throat. Reed's partner began to whack at her with the pistol butt. It didn't faze her. Arterial blood pumped out around her lips. Reed remembered his own weapon. He raised it and shot. The bullet entered through the young woman's eye and her body went loose, but her mouth remained locked on Vern's throat. She appeared to be drinking his blood. On his knees, Reed dug his fingers into the hot and slippery mess where the young woman's teeth were clamped to his partner's throat. He hauled and pulled, feeling tongue and enamel. Vern swung at her once more, ineffectually, his gun flying from his relaxing hand and bouncing away. Then he collapsed. 7. Last in a 3 cruiser caravan, Frank drove alone. Everyone had their sirens going. Ordway and Terry were at the 4, followed by Peters and Peters' sidekick, Blass. Aloneness was not something that Frank sought, but it seemed to find him. Why was that? Elaine had taken Nana and left him alone. Oscar Silver had gone off the road and left him alone. It was grim. It had made him grim. Maybe that was how it had to be, though, how he had to be, to do what he had to do. But could he do what he had to do? Things were going wrong. Reed Barrows had radioed that shots had been fired and there was an officer down. Frank believed he was ready to kill for his daughter. He was certain that he was ready to die for her.
What occurred to him now, though, was that he was not the only one who was willing to take mortal risks. Norcross's people had stolen police armaments and broken through a barricade. Whatever their reasons, they were determined. It worried Frank that they should be so determined, that their reasons should be such an enigma. What was driving them? What was it between Eve Black and Norcross? His cell phone rang. The caravan was speeding north on Balls Hill. Frank pulled the phone from his pocket. Geary.
Frank, this is Eve Black.
She spoke a shade above a whisper, and her voice had a husky, flirty quality.
It is it? Nice to meet you.
I'm calling you from my new cell phone. I didn't have one, so Lore Hicks gifted me his. Wasn't that chivalrous of him? By the way, you might as well slow down. No need to risk an accident. The RV got away. There's just 4 dead people and Reed Barrows.
How do you know that?
Trust me, I know.
Clint was surprised it was so easy to pull off the heist. I was too, to be honest. We had a good laugh.
I thought you were a little more on top of things. My mistake.
You should give yourself up, Ms. Black.
Frank concentrated on measuring his words, on keeping the redness that wanted to overtake his mind at bay.
Or you should give this thing up, whatever it is. You should do that before anyone gets hurt.
Oh, we're pretty well past the getting hurt stage. Judge Silver, for instance, got a lot more than hurt. As did Dr. Flickinger, who actually wasn't such a bad fellow when his head was clear. We're in the mass extinction stage.
Frank choked the wheel of the cruiser.
What the fuck are you?
I could ask you the same question, but I know what you'd say.
I am the good father.
Because with you, it's all Nana, 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 isn't it? The protective daddy. Have you thought even once about all the other women and what you might be doing to them? What you might be putting at risk?
How do you know about my daughter?
It's my business to know. There's an old blues song that goes, "Before you accuse me, take a look at yourself." You need to widen your perspective, Frank.
What I need, Frank Geary thought, is my hands around your throat. What do you want?
I want you to man up. I want you to man the fuck up and make this interesting. I want your precious Nana to be able to go to school and say, my daddy isn't just a civil servant who catches feral cats, and he isn't just a guy who punches walls or pulls on my favorite shirt or yells at mom when things aren't going his way. He's also the man who stopped that wicked old fairy who put all the women to sleep.
Leave my daughter out of it, you bitch.
The teasing note evaporated from her voice.
When you protected her at the hospital, that was brave. I admired it. I admired you. I truly did. I know you love her, and that's no small thing. I know, in your way, all you want is the best for her. And that makes me love you a tiny bit, even though you're part of the problem.
Ahead, the first 2 vehicles were pulling to a stop beside Reed Barrows' dented cruiser. Frank could see Barrows walking to meet them. Further on, he could see the bodies in the road.
Stop this, said Frank. Let them go. Let the women go. Not just my wife and daughter. All of them.
Evie said, you'll have to kill me first.
8. Angel asked who was this Frank that Evie had been talking to.
He's the Dragon Slayer, Evie said. I just needed to make sure that he wasn't going to allow himself to be distracted by unicorns.
You are so fucking crazy, Angel whistled.
Evie wasn't, but it wasn't an issue to debate with Angel, who, anyway, was entitled to her opinion. Chapter 9. 1. The fox comes to Lila in a dream. She knows it's a dream because the fox can talk. "Hey, babe," he says as he pads into the bedroom of the house on St. George Street she's now sharing with Tiffany, Janice Coates, and two of the docs from the Women's Center, Aaron Eisenberg and Jolie Surratt. Aaron and Jolie are unmarried. The third Women's Center doctor, Georgia Pekins, lives on the other side of town, with two daughters who sorely miss their big brother. Another reason to know this is a dream is that she's alone in the room. The other twin bed, where Tiffany sleeps, is empty and neatly made up. The fox puts its cunning forepaws, white rather than red, as if he has walked through fresh paint to get here, on the quilt that covers her. "What do you want?" Lila asks. "To show you the way back," the fox says. "But only if you want to go." 2. When Lila opened her eyes, it was morning. Tiffany was in the other bed where she belonged, the blankets pushed down to her knees, her belly a half moon above the boxer shorts she slept in. She was over 7 months now. Instead of going to the kitchen to brew up a nasty-tasting mess of the chicory that served them as coffee in this version of dueling, Lila went straight down the hall and opened the front door to a pleasant spring morning. Time passed with such slippery limberness here. Watches kept ordinary time, but there was really nothing ordinary about it. The fox was there, as she'd known it would be, sitting on the weed-choked slate path with its brush of a tail curled neatly around its paws. It regarded Lila with bright interest. "Hey, babe," Lila said. The fox cocked its head and seemed to smile. Then it trotted down the path to the broken street and sat again, watching her, waiting. Lila went to wake Tiffany up. 3. In the end, 17 residents of our place followed the fox in 6 of the solar-powered golf carts, a caravan trundling slowly out of town and then along what had been Route 31 toward Balls Hill. Tiffany rode in the lead cart along with Janice and Lila, grousing the whole way about not being allowed to ride her horse. This had been nixed by Aaron and Jolie, who were concerned about the strength of Tiff's contractions when she still had 6 or 8 weeks to go. This much they had told the mom-to-be herself. What they hadn't passed on, although Lila and Janice knew, were their worries for the baby, which had been conceived while Tiffany was still using drugs on a daily, sometimes hourly, basis. Mary Pack, Magda Dubcek, the 4 members of the First Thursday Book Club, and 5 erstwhile dueling correctional inmates were going. Also along was Elaine Nutting, formerly Geary. She rode with the 2 lady docs. Her daughter had wanted to come, but Elaine had put her foot down and kept it down even when tears began to flow. Nana had been left with old Mrs. Ransom and her granddaughter. The 2 girls had become fast friends, but not even the prospect of spending a day with Molly had cheered Nana up. She wanted to follow the fox, she said, because it was like something out of a fairy tale. She wanted to draw it. "Stay with your little girl if you want," Lila had told Elaine. "We've got plenty of people." "What I want is to see what that thing wants," Elaine had replied, although in truth she didn't know if she did or not. The fox, now sitting in front of the slumped ruin of Pearson's barbershop and waiting patiently for the women to assemble and get moving, filled her with a sense of foreboding, unfocused but strong. "Come on," Tiffany called grumpily. "Before I need to pee again." And so they followed the fox as it trotted out of town along the faded white line in the center of the highway, occasionally looking back to make sure his troop was still there, seeming to grin, seeming almost to say, "There sure are some fine-looking women in the audience today." It was an outing, a strange one, granted, but still a day off from their various chores and jobs, and there should have been talking and laughter. But the women in the trundling line of golf carts were almost silent. The headlamps of the carts came on when they were rolling, and as they went past the jungle that had once been Adam's lumberyard, the thought came to Lila that they looked more like a funeral cortege than gals on an outing.
When the fox left the highway for an overgrown track a quarter mile past the lumberyard, Tiffany stiffened and put her hands protectively on her belly.
No, no, no. You can stop right here and let me out. I ain't going back to True Mayweather's trailer, not even if it ain't no more than a pile of scrap metal.
That's not where we're going, Lila said.
How do you know?
Wait and see. As it turned out, the remains of the trailer were barely visible. A storm had knocked it off its blocks, and it lay on its side in high weeds and brambles like a rusty dinosaur. 30 or 40 yards from it, the fox cut left and slipped into the woods. The women in the two lead carts saw a ruddy orange flash of fur, then it vanished. Lila dismounted and went to where it had entered the woods. The ruins of the nearby shed had been entirely overgrown, but even after all this time, a sallow chemical smell remained. The meth may be gone, Lila thought, but the memories linger on. Even here, where time seems to gallop, pause for breath, then gallop again. Janice, Magda, and Blanche McIntyre joined her. Tiffany remained in the golf cart, holding her belly. She looked ill. There's a game trail, Lila said, pointing. We can follow it without much trouble.
I'm not going in those woods either, Tiffany said. I don't care if that fox does a tap dance. I'm having goddamn contractions again.
You wouldn't be going even if you weren't having them, Aaron said. I'll stay with you. Jolie, you can go if you want.
Jolie did. The 15 women went up the game trail in single file, Lila in the lead, and the former Mrs. Frank Geary bringing up the rear. They had been walking for almost 10 minutes when Lila stopped and raised her arms, index fingers pointing both left and right like a traffic cop who can't make up her mind.
Holy shit, Celia Frode said. I never seen nothing like that. Never.
The branches of the poplars, birches, and alders on either side were furred with moths. There seemed to be millions of them.
What if they attack?
Elaine murmured, keeping her voice low and thanking God that she hadn't given in to Nana's demands to be brought along.
They won't, Lila said.
How can you know that?
Elaine demanded.
I just do, Lila said.
They're like the fox. She hesitated, searching for the right word. They're emissaries.
For who?
Blanche asked. Or what? This was another question Lila chose not to answer, although she could have. Come on, she said. Not far now. 4. 15 women stood in thigh-high grass, staring at what Lila had come to think of as the amazing tree. No one said anything for perhaps 30 seconds. Then, in a high, gasping voice, Jolie Surratt said,
My good God in heaven.
The tree rose like a living pylon in the sun, its various knotted trunks weaving around each other, sometimes concentrating shafts of sunlight filled with dusty pollen, sometimes creating dark caves. Tropical birds disported among its many branches and gossiped in its ferny leaves. In front of it, the peacock Lila had seen before strutted back and forth like the world's most elegant doorman. The red snake was there too, hanging from a branch, a reptilian trapeze artist penduluming lazily back and forth. Below the snake was a dark crevasse where the various bowls seemed to draw back. Lila didn't remember this, but she wasn't surprised. Nor was she when the fox popped out of it like Jack from his box and took a playful snap at the peacock, who paid him no mind. Janice Coates took Lila's arm.
Are we seeing this?
Yes, Lila said. Celia, Magda, and Jolie screamed shrilly in piercing three-part harmony. The white tiger was emerging from the split in the many-bowled trunk. It surveyed the women at the edge of the clearing with its green eyes, then stretched long and low, seeming almost to bow to them.
Stand still, Lila shouted. Stand still, all of you. It won't harm you. hoping with all her heart and soul that it was true. The tiger touched noses with the fox. It turned to the women again, seeming to fix on Lila with particular interest. Then it paced around the tree and out of sight.
"My God," Kitty McDavid said. She was weeping. "How beautiful was that? How fucking oh my God beautiful was that?"
Magda Dubček said,
"This is Svaté místo,
holy place."
And she crossed herself. Janice was looking at Lila.
"Tell me."
"I think," Lila said, "it's a way out. A way back. If we want it." That was when the walkie-talkie on her belt came to life. There was a burst of static and no way to make out words. But it sounded like Aaron to Lila, and it sounded like she was yelling. 5. Tiffany was stretched across the front seat of the golf cart. An old St. Louis Rams t-shirt that she had scrounged somewhere lay crumpled on the ground. Her breasts, once little more than nubbins, jutted skyward in a plain D-cup cotton bra. The Lycra ones were now totally useless. Aaron was bent between her legs with her hands splayed on that amazing mound of belly. As the women came running, some brushing twigs and the odd moth from their hair, Aaron bore down. Tiffany shrieked,
"Stop that! Oh, for God's sake, stop!"
And her legs shot out in a V. "What are you doing?" Lila asked, reaching her. But when she looked down, what Aaron was doing and why she was doing it became obvious. Tiff's jeans were unzipped. There was a stain on the blue denim, and the cotton of Tiff's underpants was a damp pink. "The baby is coming, and its butt is where its head should be," Aaron said. "Oh my God, a breech," Kitty said. "I have to turn it around," Aaron said. "Get us back to town, Lila." "We'll have to straighten her up," Lila said. "I can't drive until you do that." With the help of Jolie and Blanche McIntyre, Lila got Tiffany to a half-sitting position with Aaron crammed in next to her. Tiffany screamed again.
"Oh, that hurts!"
Lila slid behind the wheel of the cart, her right shoulder tight against Tiffany's left one. Aaron had turned almost sideways to fit. "How fast will this thing go?" she asked. "I don't know, but we're going to find out." Lila hit the accelerator pedal, wincing at Tiff's howl of pain as the cart jerked forward. Tiffany screamed at every jounce, and there were a lot of jounces. At that moment, the amazing tree with its freight of exotic birds was the farthest thing from Lila Norcross's mind. This was not true of the former Elaine Geary. 6. They stopped at the Olympia Diner. Tiffany was in too much pain to go further. Aaron sent Janice and Magda back to town to get her bag, while Lila and three other women carried Tiffany inside.
"Pull a couple of the tables together," said Aaron,
"and do it fast. I need to straighten this baby out now, and I need Mom lying down to do it." Lila and Mary pushed over the tables. Margaret and Gail hefted Tiffany atop them, grimacing and turning their faces away, as if she were throwing mud at them instead of screams of objection. Aaron went back to work on Tiffany's stomach, kneading it like dough.
"I think it's starting to move, praise God. Come on, Junior, how about a little somersault for Dr. E?"
Aaron bore down on Tiff's stomach with one hand while Jolie Surratt pushed sideways.
"Stop!" Tiffany screamed. "Stop it, you fuckers!"
"It's turning," said Aaron, ignoring the profanity. "Really turning, thank God. Yank her pants off, Lila. Pants and underpants. Jolie, keep pressing. Don't let it turn back." Lila took one leg of Tiffany's jeans. Celia froed the other. They yanked and the old denims came off. Tiffany's underpants came with them part way, leaving brush strokes of blood and amniotic fluid on her thighs. Lila pulled them the rest of the way. They were heavy with liquid, warm and sopping. She felt her gorge rise, then settle back into place. The screams were constant now, Tiffany's head lashing from side to side.
"I can't wait for the bag," Aaron said. "This baby is coming right now. Only..."
She looked at her former office mate, who nodded.
"Somebody get Jolie a knife. A sharp one. We have to cut her a little.
I gotta push, Tiffany panted.
The hell you do, Jolie said. Not yet. The door's open, but we need to take the hinges off. Make a little more room. Lila found a steak knife, and in the bathroom, an ancient bottle of hydrogen peroxide. She doused the blade, stopped to consider the hand sanitizer by the door, and tried it. Nothing. The stuff inside had evaporated long ago. She hurried back. The women had surrounded Tiffany, Aaron, and Jolie in a semicircle. All were holding hands except for Elaine Geary, who had her arms wrapped tightly around her midsection. She was directing her gaze first to the counter, then to the empty booths, then out the door, anywhere but at the panting, screaming woman on the makeshift operating table, now mother naked, save for an old cotton bra. Jolie took the knife. Did you disinfect it with something? Hydrogen per... That'll do, Aaron said. Mary, find me a styrofoam cooler, if there's one around. One of you other ladies get towels. There'll be some in the kitchen. Put them on top of the... A miserable howl from Tiffany as Jolie Surratt performed a steak knife episiotomy, sans anesthetic. Put the towels on top of the golf carts, Aaron finished.
Oh, yeah, the solar panels. That was Kitty. To heat them up. Hey, that's pretty smart.
We want them warm but not hot, Aaron said. I have no intention of roasting our newest citizen. Go on. Elaine stood where she was, letting the other women wash around her like water around a rock, continuing to direct her gaze at any object that was not Tiffany Jones. Her eyes were shiny and shallow. How close is she? Lila asked.
7 centimeters, Jolie said. She'll be at 10 before you can say Jack Robinson. Cervical effacement is complete, one thing that went right at least. Push, Tiffany. Save a little for next time, though.
Tiffany pushed. Tiffany screamed. Tiffany's vagina flexed, then closed, then opened again. Fresh blood flowed between her legs.
I don't like the blood.
Lila heard Aaron mutter this to Jolie from the side of her mouth, like a racetrack tout passing on a hot tip. There's way too much. Christ, I wish I at least had my fetoscope. Mary came back with the sort of hard plastic cooler Lila had toted to Maylock Lake many times when she and Clint and Jared used to go on picnics there. Printed on the side was Budweiser, the king of beers.
Will this do, Dr. E?
Fine, Aaron said, but didn't look up. Okay, Tiff, big push.
My back is killing me,
Tiffany said. But me became me as her face contorted and her fists beat up and down on the chipped formica of the tabletop.
I see its head, Lila shouted. I see its face. Oh, Christ, Aaron, what?
Aaron pushed Jolie aside and seized one of the baby's shoulders before it could retreat, her fingertips pressing deep in a way that made Lila feel ill. The baby's head slid forward, tilted strenuously to one side, as if it was trying to look back to where it had come from. The eyes were shut, the face ashy gray. Looped around the neck and up one cheek toward the ear, like a hangman's noose, was a blood-spotted umbilical cord that made Lila think of the red snake hanging from the amazing tree. From the chest down, the infant was still inside its mother, but one arm had slithered free and hung down limply. Lila could see each perfect finger, each perfect nail. Quit pushing, Aaron said. I know you want to finish it, but don't push yet.
I need to,
Tiffany rasped.
You'll strangle your baby if you do,
Jolie said. She was back beside Aaron, shoulder to shoulder.
Wait, just give me a second.
Too late, thought Lila. It's already strangled. You only have to look at that gray face. Jolie worked one finger beneath the umbilical cord, then two. She flexed the fingers in a come-on gesture, first pulling the cord away from the infant's neck, and then slipping it off. Tiffany screamed, every tendon in her neck standing out in stark relief.
Push, Aaron said, just as hard as you can. On three.
Jolie, don't let it faceplant on this filthy fucking floor when it comes.
Tiff, one. Two, three.
Tiffany pushed. The baby seemed to shoot into Jolie Surratt's hands.
It was slimy, it was beautiful, and it was dead.
Straw! Jolie shouted. Get a straw! Now!
Elaine stepped forward. Lila hadn't seen her move. She already had one ready, the paper stripped off.
Here.
Aaron took the straw. Lila, Aaron said, open his mouth. His. Until then, Lila hadn't noticed the tiny gray comma below the baby's stomach.
Open his mouth, Aaron repeated.
Carefully, Lila used two fingers to do as she was told. Aaron put one end of the straw in her own mouth and the other in the tiny opening Lila's fingers had created. Now push up on his chin, Jolie instructed. Gotta create suction. What point? Dead was dead. But Lila once more obeyed orders and saw shadowy crescents appear in Aaron Eisenberg's cheeks as she sucked on her end. There was an audible sound. Flup. Aaron turned her head aside to spit out what looked like a wad of phlegm. Then she nodded to Jolie, who raised the baby to her face and blew gently into its mouth. The baby just lay there, head back, beads of blood and foam on its bald head. Jolie blew again, and a miracle happened. The tiny chest heaved. The blue eyes popped sightlessly open. He began to wail. Celia Frode started the applause, and the others joined in, except for Elaine, who had retreated to where she was earlier, her arms once again clasping her midsection. The baby's cries were constant now, its hands made tiny fists.
That's my baby, Tiffany said and raised her arms. My baby is crying. Give him to me.
Jolie tied off the umbilical cord with a rubber band and wrapped the baby in the first thing that came to hand, a waitress's apron someone had grabbed from a coat hook. She passed the wailing bundle to Tiffany, who looked into his face, laughed, and kissed one gummy cheek. Where are those towels? Aaron demanded. Get them now.
They won't be too warm yet, Kitty said.
Get them. The towels were brought, and Mary lined the Budweiser cooler with them. While she did, Lila saw more blood gushing from between Tiffany's legs. A lot of blood. Pints, maybe.
Is that normal?
Someone asked. Perfectly. Aaron's voice was firm and sure, confidence personified. Absolutely no problem here. That was when Lila began to suspect that Tiffany was probably going to die. But someone bring me more towels. Jolie Surratt moved to take the baby from his mother and put him in the makeshift Budweiser bassinet. Aaron shook her head. Let her hold him a little longer. That was when Lila knew for sure. 7. Sundown in what had once been the town of Dueling and was now our place. Lila was sitting on the front stoop of the house on St. George Street, with a stapled sheaf of paper in her hands when Janice Coates came up the walk. When Janice sat down next to her, Lila caught a scent of juniper. From a pocket inside her quilted vest, the ex-warden removed the source, a pint bottle of Shenley's gin. She held it out to Lila. Lila shook her head. Retained placenta, Janice said. That's what Aaron told me. No way to scrape it out, at least not in time to stop the bleeding. And none of that drug they use. Pitocin, Lila said. I had it when Jared was born. They sat quiet for a while, watching the light drain from what had been a very long day. At last, Janice said, I thought you might like some help cleaning out her stuff. Already done. She didn't have much. None of us do. Which is sort of a relief, don't you think? We learned a poem in school, something about getting and spending, laying waste to all our powers. Keats, maybe. Lila, who had learned the same poem, knew it was Wordsworth, but said nothing. Janice returned the bottle to the pocket it had come from and brought out a relatively clean handkerchief. She used it to wipe first one of Lila's cheeks, then the other, an action that brought back painfully sweet memories of Lila's mother, who had done the same thing on the many occasions when her daughter, a self-confessed tomboy, had taken a tumble from her bike or her skateboard. I found this in the dresser where she was keeping her baby things, Lila said, handing Janice the thin pile of pages. It was under some nightshirts and booties. On the front, Tiffany had pasted a picture of a laughing, perfectly permed mommy holding up a laughing baby in a shaft of golden sunlight. Janice was pretty sure it had been clipped from a Gerber baby food ad in an old women's magazine, maybe Good Housekeeping. Below it, Tiffany had lettered, Andrew Jones, Book for a Good Life. She knew it was a boy, Lila said. I don't know how she knew, but she did. Magda told her, some old wives' tale about carrying high. She must have been working on this for quite a while, and I never saw her at it. Lila wondered if Tiffany had been embarrassed. Look at the first page. That's what started the waterworks. Janice opened the little homemade book. Lila leaned close to her, and they read it together. 10 Rules for Good Living. 1. Be kind to others, and they will be kind to you. 2. Do not use drugs for fun, ever. 3. If you are wrong, apologize. 4. God sees what you do wrong, but he is kind and will forgive. 5. Do not tell lies, as that becomes a habit. 6. Never whip a horse. 7. Your body is your temple, so do not smoke. 8. Do not cheat. Give everyone a square shake. 9. Be careful of the friends you choose. I was not. 10. Remember, your mother will always love you, and you will be okay. It was the last one that really got me, Lila said. It still does. Give me that bottle. I guess I need a nip after all. Janice handed it over. Lila swallowed, grimaced, and handed it back. How's the baby? Okay? Considering he was born 6 weeks shy of term and wearing his umbilical cord for a necklace, he's doing very well, Janice said. Thank God we had Aaron and Jolie along, or we would have lost them both. He's with Linda Bear and Linda's baby. Linda quit nursing Alex a little while ago, but as soon as she heard Andy crying, her milk came right back in, so she says. Meanwhile, we've got another tragedy on our hands. As if Tiffany wasn't enough for one day, Lila thought, and tried to put her game face on. Tell me, Gerda Holden, oldest of the 4 Holden girls, she's disappeared. Which almost certainly meant something mortal had happened to her in that other world. They all accepted this as a fact now. How's Clara taking it? About as you'd expect, Janice replied. She's half out of her mind. She and all the girls have been experiencing that weird vertigo for the last week or so, so someone's moving them around. Janice shrugged. Maybe, probably. Whatever it is, Clara's afraid another of her girls is going to blip out of existence at any moment. Maybe all 3 of them. I'd be afraid, too. She began flipping through the Andrew Jones Book for a Good Life. Every page was filled with an expansion of the 10 rules. Should we talk about the tree? Lila asked. Janice considered, then shook her head. Maybe tomorrow. Tonight I just want to sleep. Lila, who wasn't sure she could sleep, took Janice's hand and squeezed it. 8. Nana had asked her mother if she could sleep over with Molly at Mrs. Ransom's house, and Elaine gave her permission after ascertaining that it would be all right with the old lady. Of course, Mrs. Ransom said. Molly and I love Nana. That was good enough for the former Elaine Geary, who was for once glad to have her little girl out of the house. Nana was her dear one, her jewel, a rare point of agreement with her estranged husband, and one that had kept the marriage together longer than it might have survived otherwise. But this evening, Elaine had an important errand to run, One that was more for Nana than it was for her. For all the women of dueling, really. Some of them, Lila Norcross, for instance, might not understand that now, but they would later. If, that was, she decided to go through with it. The golf carts they'd taken on the expedition to that weird tree in the woods were all neatly parked in the lot behind what was left of the municipal building. One good thing you could say for women, she thought, one of many things, was that they usually put things away when they were done with them. Men were different. They left their possessions scattered hell to breakfast. How many times had she told Frank to put his dirty clothes in the hamper? Wasn't it enough that she washed them and ironed them without having to pick them up as well? And how many times did she still find them in the bathroom outside the shower, or littered across the bedroom floor? And could he be bothered to rinse a glass or wash a dish after a late-night snack? No. It was as if dishes and glasses became invisible once their purpose had been served. The fact that her husband kept his office immaculate and his animal cages spotless made such thoughtless behavior more irritating. Small things, you would say, and who could disagree? They were. But over the course of years, those things became a domestic version of an old Chinese torture she'd read about in a Time Life book that she'd pulled out of a donation box at Goodwill. The Death of a Thousand Cuts, it was called. Frank's bad temper had only been the worst and deepest of those cuts. Oh, sometimes there was a present, or a soft kiss on the back of the neck, or a dinner out with candlelight. But those things were just frosting on a stale and hard-to-chew cake. The cake of marriage. She was not prepared to say every man was the same, but the majority were, because the instincts came with the package. With the penis. A man's home was his castle, so the saying went, and etched into the XY chromosome was a deep belief that every man was a king and every woman his serving maid. The keys were still in the carts. Of course they were. There might be an occasional case of petty pilfering in our place, but there had been no real theft. That was one of the nice things about it. There were many nice things, but not everyone could be content with those things. Take all the whining and whinging that went on at the meetings, for instance. Nana had been at some of those meetings. She didn't think Elaine knew, but Elaine did. A good mother monitors her child and knows when she is being infected by bad companions with bad ideas. 2 days ago, it had been Molly at their house, and the two girls had a wonderful time, first playing outside, hopscotch and jump rope, then inside, redecorating the large dollhouse Elaine had felt justified in liberating from the dueling mercantile, then outside again until the sun went down. They had eaten a huge supper, after which Molly had walked the 2 blocks back to her house in the gloaming, by herself. And why could she do that? Because in this world there were no predators, no pedophiles. A happy day. And that was why Elaine was so surprised, and a bit fearful, why not admit it, when she had paused outside her daughter's door on the way to bed and heard Nana crying. Elaine chose a golf cart, turned the key, and towed the little round accelerator pedal. She rolled soundlessly out of the lot and down Main Street, past the dead streetlights and dark storefronts. 2 miles out of town, she reached a neat white building with 2 useless gas pumps out front. The sign on the roof proclaimed it the Dueling Country Living Store. The owner, Kabir Patel, was gone, of course, as were his 3 well-mannered, in public at least, sons. His wife had been visiting her family in India when the Aurora struck, and was presumably cocooned in Mumbai or Lucknow or one of those other places. Mr. Patel had sold a bit of everything. It was the only way to compete with the supermarket, but most of it was gone now. The liquor had disappeared first, of course. Women liked to drink, and who taught them to enjoy it? Other women? Rarely. Without pausing to look in the darkened store, Elaine drove her golf cart around to the back. Here was a long metal annex with a sign out front reading Country Living Store, Auto Supply Shop, come here first and save. Mr. Patel had kept it neat. She would give him points for that. Elaine's father had done small engine repair to supplement his income as a plumber, in Clarksburg, this had been, and the two sheds out back where he worked had been dotted with cast-off parts, bald tires, and any number of derelict mowers and rototillers. An eyesore, Elaine's mother had complained. It pays for your Fridays at the beauty salon, replied the king of the castle, and so the mess had remained. Elaine needed to put her whole weight against one of the doors before it would move on its dirty track, but eventually she got it to slide 4 or 5 feet, and that was all she needed.
What's the matter, sweetie?
She had asked her crying daughter, before she'd known that damn tree existed, when she'd thought her child's tears were the only problem she had, and that they would end as quickly as a spring shower.
Does your tummy hurt from supper?
No, Nana said. And you don't need to call it my tummy, Mom. I'm not 5.
That exasperated tone was new and set Elaine back on her heels a bit, but she continued to stroke Nana's hair.
What is it, then?
Nana's lips had tightened, trembled, and then she had burst.
I miss Daddy. I miss Billy. He held my hand sometimes when we walked to school, and that was nice. He was nice, but mostly I miss Daddy. I want this vacation to be over. I want to go back home.
Instead of stopping, as spring showers did, her weeping had become a storm. When Elaine tried to stroke her cheek, Nana knocked her hand away and sat up in bed with her hair wild and staticky around her face. In that moment, Elaine saw Frank in her. She saw him so clearly, it was scary.
Don't you remember how he shouted at us? Elaine asked. And the time he punched the wall? That was awful, wasn't it?
He shouted at you, Nana shouted. At you, because you always wanted him to do something, or get something, or be something different. I don't know, but he never shouted at me.
He pulled your shirt, though, Elaine said.
Her disquiet deepened into something like horror. Had she thought Nana had forgotten Frank, relegated him to the junk heap along with her invisible friend, Mrs. Humpty Dump?
It was your favorite, too. Because he was afraid of the man with the car, the one who ran over the cat. He was taking care of me. Remember when he yelled at your teacher? Remember how embarrassed you were?
I don't care. I want him.
Nana, that's enough. You've made your...
I want my daddy.
You need to close your eyes and go to sleep and have sweet dreams.
I want my daddy.
Elaine had left the room, closing the door gently behind her. What an effort it had been not to descend to the child's level and slam it. Even now, standing in Mr. Patel's oil-smelling shed, she would not admit how close she had come to shouting at her daughter. It wasn't Nana's strident tone, so unlike her usual soft and tentative voice. It wasn't even the physical resemblance to Frank, which she could usually overlook. It was how much she sounded like him as she made her unreasonable and unfulfillable demands. It was almost as if Frank Geary had reached across from the other side of whatever gulf separated that violent old world from this new one and possessed her child. Nana had seemed her old self the next day, but Elaine had been unable to stop thinking about the tears heard through the door and the way Nana knocked away the hand that had meant only to comfort, and that ugly, yelling voice that came from Nana's child's mouth. I want my daddy. Nor was that all. She had been holding hands with ugly little Billy Beeson from down the block. She missed her little boyfriend, who probably would have enjoyed taking her behind a bush so they could play doctor. It was even easy to imagine Nana and the scabrous Billy at 16 making out in the back of his father's club cab, French kissing her and auditioning her for the position of first cook and bottle washer in his shitty little castle. Forget about drawing pictures, Nana. Get out in the kitchen and rattle those pots and pans. Fold my clothes, haul my ashes, then I'll burp and roll over and go to sleep. Elaine had brought a crank flashlight, which she now shone on the interior of the auto annex, which had been left alone. With no fuel to run Dueling's autos, there was no need for fan belts and spark plugs. So what she was looking for might be here. Plenty of that stuff had been stored in her father's workshop, and the oily smell in this one was just the same. bringing back with startling vividness memories of the pigtailed girl she'd been, but not with nostalgia, oh no. Handing her father parts and tools as he called for them, stupidly happy when he thanked her, cringing if he scolded her for being slow or grabbing the wrong thing, because she had wanted to please him. He was her daddy, big and strong, and she wanted to please him in all things. This world was ever so much better than the old man-driven one. No one yelled at her here, and no one yelled at Nana. No one treated them like second-class citizens. This was a world where a little girl could walk home by herself, even after dark, and feel safe. A world where a little girl's talent could grow along with her hips and breasts. No one would nip it in the bud. Nana didn't understand that, and she wasn't alone. If you didn't think so, all you had to do was listen in at one of those stupid meetings. I think it's a way out, Lila had said as the women stood in the tall grass looking at that weird tree. And oh God, if she was right. Elaine walked deeper into the auto supply shed, training the flashlight beam on the floor because the floor was concrete, and concrete kept things cool. And there, in the far corner, was what she had been hoping for. 3 5-gallon cans with their pour tops screwed down tight. They were plain metal, unmarked, but there was a thick red rubber band girdling one of them, and blue bands around the other two. Her father had marked his tins of kerosene in exactly the same way. I think it's a way out, a way back, if we want it. Some of them undoubtedly would. The meeting women who couldn't understand what a good thing they had here. What a fine thing. What a safe thing. These were the ones so socialized to generations of servitude that they would eagerly rush back into their chains. The ones from the prison would, counterintuitively, probably be the first to want to go home to the old world, and right back into the pokey from which they'd been released. So many of these childish creatures were unable or unwilling to realize that there was nearly always some unindicted male co-conspirator behind their incarceration. Some man for whom they'd degraded themselves. In her years as a volunteer, Elaine had seen it and heard it all a million times over. He's got a good heart. He doesn't mean it. He promises he'll change. Hell, she was vulnerable to it herself. In the midst of that endless day and night, before they fell asleep and were transported, she'd almost let herself believe, in spite of everything she'd experienced with Frank in the past, that he would do what she asked, that he would get control of his temper. Of course he hadn't. Elaine didn't believe Frank could change. It was his male nature, but he had changed her. Sometimes she thought that Frank had driven her mad. To him, she was the scold, the taskmaster, the grating alarm bell that ended recess each day. It awed her, Frank's obliviousness to the weight of her responsibilities. Did he actually believe it made her happy, having to remind him to pay bills, to pick up things, to keep his temper in check? She was certain that he actually did. Elaine was not blind. She saw that her husband was not a contented man. But he did not see her at all. She had to act for the sake of Nana and all the others. That was what had come into focus that very afternoon, even as Tiffany Jones was dying in that diner, giving up the last of her poor, wrecked life so that a child might live. There would be women who wanted to return. Not a majority. Elaine had to believe most of the women here were not so insane, so masochistic. But could she take that chance? Could she, when her own sweet Nana, who had shrunk into herself every time her father raised his voice, "Stop thinking about it," she told herself. "Concentrate on your business." The red band meant cheap kerosene and would probably be of no more use to her than the gasoline stored under the town's various service stations. You could douse a lit match in red band kerosene once it was old. But those blue bands meant that a stabilizer had been added, and that kind might retain its volatility for 10 years or more. The tree they'd found that day might be amazing, but it was still a tree, and trees burned. There was the tiger to reckon with, of course, but she would take a gun. scare it away, shoot it if necessary. She knew how to shoot. Her father had taught her. Part of her thought that might turn out to be a needless precaution. Lila had called the tiger and the fox emissaries, and to Elaine, that felt right. She had an idea that the tiger would not try to stop her, that the tree was essentially unguarded. If it was a door, it needed to be closed for good. Someday Nana would understand and thank her for doing the right thing.